Hey, it's NPR's Book of the Day. I'm Andrew Limbong. Poetry is more of a kind of diagnosis than it is a calling. That's something said by one of our guests on the pod today, and he's kidding, I think, but maybe not, because today we've got two discussions that are fundamentally about the type of person who can write poetry. In a bit, we'll hear from Michael Ondaatje, the author of the book The English Patient, who talks about amphibious writers, you know, writers who can do both prose and poetry well. Think Raymond Carver or Louise Erdrich. But first, the guy who said that quote I opened with, Don Patterson, the acclaimed Scottish poet who's out with a memoir titled Toy Fights. And he talked to NPR's Scott Simon about why a famous poet would write a book that doesn't mention poetry. That's ahead.
This message comes from NPR sponsor HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. On The Sympathizer podcast, host Philip Nguyen joins the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen to discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Don Patterson is one of the great poets in the world. He's the only poet to twice win the T.S. Eliot Prize and is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. But he left school at the age of 16 to play guitar. There's scarcely any references to poetry in his childhood memoir of growing up in a working-class housing block in Dundee, Scotland, during the 1970s. There are telling and hilarious recollections, like this about bedwetting.
Dad tried to incentivize my continence by putting a star on the door when I had a dry night, with the promise of reward once the door was full. This isn't a great system, but it works much better than battering the child into compliance or humiliating them before their peers. That I could manage myself. I recall sitting outside in the closed steps in front of the tenement with the bigger kids, who were discussing what guns and outfits they were saving up for. I don't know what possessed me to breezily chip in with, "Yeah, if I don't wet the bed for another 6 weeks, I'm getting an action man." But the remark didn't quite win the nods of chin-stroking approval I'd hoped for.
Don Patterson's memoir is called Toy Fights, and he joins us now. Thank you so much for being with us.
That's a pleasure, Scott.
Tell us a little about that three-story building where you lived. You're right, there was so much more early death on the street than I took in at the time.
Yeah, it was fairly typical. I mean, I think because so much of the housing in Dundee was owned by the council and it was so homogenous, you didn't really notice anything, you know, because there were no exceptions to it. But looking back, it was a very poor neighbourhood. But as a consequence of that, and the usual factors like intergenerational trauma and the experience of the men coming back from the war and then the high levels of alcoholism, yeah, it would be true to say that life expectancy wasn't the highest in our street.
What drew you as a child, in Scotland after all, to the music of those American outlaws, Willie and Kris Kristofferson?
It's interesting. I had to think about this. And I suppose it's in a way we saw it as what had initially happened in reverse, because, of course, Celtic music itself is a great kind of cultural input into country music. So it was just that music coming home again. But it was hugely popular in Scotland, so it wasn't unusual to be into it. But my father was a massive enthusiast. He started as a folk musician and then later became a country musician. And that was his love.
You write about a deeply religious period that you went through in your life?
Well, yeah, I sort of became a kind of Pentecostal Christian, but and my reasons for doing so were kind of complicated. I think I was trying to square the circle of, on the one hand, pleasing my mother, but also kind of trying to be a worry to my parents as part of the kind of adolescent contract. So I found a way of sort of, you know, as I say, squaring the circle by adopting a form of Christianity that was so extreme as to be quite a worry to them. So I went the full kind of charismatic Christian and spoke in tongues and all that stuff.
I want to get you to talk about what you, what you very bluntly describe as, quote, my descent into madness. What happened to deliver you into Ward 89?
It was a hard thing to unpick because, again, it was a kind of odd convergence of circumstances, but one would have been recovering from that period of religious mania. But it was also drugs. I got heavily into, you know, smoking too much dope. And at the time in Scotland, it was getting mixed with, you know, other substances. So I had a kind of unfortunate out-of-body experience that was, there was like a week-long panic attack. And after that, I was hospitalized for 4 months. It was diagnosed sort of afterwards, I discovered, as a schizophrenic episode. So that wasn't much fun.
You had, I gather, competing visions in your head.
I certainly had competing voices. I think the only thing that I took away was that there's nothing really at the center. You have to kind of create a self or construct an ego or something to hold to. Because for a while, all I had was various voices, none of whom I could identify as me. So the whole process was really sort of trying to kind of reconstruct a self just from available materials. So it was fairly horrific to watch it be dismantled in that way and realize that you didn't really have a center anymore.
Why is there almost no mention of poetry here in this memoir?
I think I rather arbitrarily or maybe sensibly decided a cut-off point would be at the age of 20, but poetry wasn't any part of my life then, so, and it didn't really kick in until I was about 21. There is one little sort of incident that I remembered, though, from when I was about 6 years old, which was kind of odd if you're a determinist, and my father had found a little book in the loft, and I'd drawn a picture of Robert Burns as a statue of Robert Burns in the middle of Dundee City Centre.
Robert Burns, the great Scottish poet.
That's right. But I'd written underneath it, when I grow up, I am going to be a poet and write poetry. And that was the last I'd thought about it for the next 15 years.
All right. Just before our interview, the producer of this segment asked you a standard question to get your voice level that he asks, what was your first car? And you said you don't drive. And I said, huzzah, because neither do I.
Excellent.
And you write in this book, as a general rule, poets can't drive and the ones who do drive shouldn't.
Yeah, I should qualify that. That's kind of male poets. You know, I know a lot of really great female poets who also drive very well, but there's something about male poets and cars that don't go well together. I'm not entirely sure what that is. But I've often kind of suspected that poetry itself is really more of a kind of a diagnosis than a calling. And I think maybe an aspect of that diagnosis is that you also can't drive.
This memoir ends at the age of 20. Does that mean stay tuned?
Initially, it meant I didn't know whether I would continue or not, but I appear to have signed the contract and be 40,000 words into the next bit. So I guess so, yeah. So it's a boyhood part two, since men remain children until the age of 40.
40?
35.
I would give you beyond that. But, Don Patterson, his memoir, Toy Fights. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Scott. It's a pleasure.
Support for NPR and the following message come from the American Cancer Society. Dr. Alpa Patel leads a team that researches cancer risk factors, and she shares how her team makes an impact.
We always do what we like to think of as actionable science. So the work that we do makes its way to things like nutrition and physical activity guidelines for cancer.org, where millions of people come each year to learn about how they can better prevent cancer.
To learn more, go to cancer.org.
I've talked to enough writers who say, oh, I always had that ending in mind, and they sort of work backwards from there. But Michael Ondaatje says that way of thinking is completely counter to how poetry should work, that poetry should be an act of discovery. His new collection is called A Year of Last Things, and here he is talking about it with NPR's Scott Simon.
Michael Ondaatje, the Booker Prize-winning novelist, has a new volume of poetry, A Year of Last Things, and it may reveal much of his wide-ranging life, from his childhood in Sri Lanka during World War II to his adolescence in London, his life in Canada, and travels all over the world. Let's ask him to read from the first poem in the book, Locke.
Reading the lines he loves, he slips them into a pocket, wishes to die with his clothes full of torn free stanzas, and the telephone numbers of his children in far cities. As if these were all we need and want, not the dog or silver bowl, not the brag of career or ownership. Unless they can be used, a bowl to beg with, a howl to send a friend, as those torn lines remind us how to recall, until we reach that horizon and drop, or rise like a canoe within a lock, to search the other half of the river, where you might see your friends as altered by this altitude as you.
Michael Ondaatje, author of The English Patient and so many other novels, joins us now from studios of the CBC in Toronto. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
What puts a poem into your mind?
I wish I knew, you know. The main thing for me is that if you know where you're going, then that's not the way to go. You know, I mean, Robert Creeley has a line, if you know what the last line of the book is, you take that line, you make it the first line. The writing of a poem is a sort of a discovery or reconnaissance. You're not quite sure where you will end up. And I've always believed that's the central rule of writing, especially poetry. In a novel, you have large plots to contend with. But in a poem, it's all to do with language and a tone or a gesture.
Is this volume a kind of memoir? I'm thinking of the lines, all those small recalls of this and that before our walk up a staircase into the dark.
Well, I've never wanted to write a memoir, and I don't think this is in any way. It essentially was made up of individual poems that wasn't in the order they were written. So once I'd written all these 50, 60 poems, I then had to kind of find a shape or an order for them that would suggest something that happened at one time and then another time and how things changed.
May I ask, who is the person you write about in The Poem Wanderer?
I have a friend named Sam Selecki who is Polish, and he's a good friend. But it really was not just about him. It was about just as much about me as it is about his family and how they escaped Poland during the war.
I mean, it's quite a story that you relate in here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his family was helped by a German person and to escape Poland during the war.
By a deserter who,
yes,
I guess, acted as a father figure? Or
he did, yeah. And he helped them get out of, Europe at that crucial time.
May I ask you to read a short and what I found startling poem?
Mm-hmm.
Page 52, The Cabbage Town Pet Clinic. And yeah. Cabbage Town, the neighborhood in Toronto, right?
Right. For years I wrote during the day above a veterinarian. The howls, the heavy breathing, the sighs from that faraway, untranslated world.
That untranslated world in which animals exist?
Yes, only animals. You know, you could hear them, you know, on the ground floor. There's a lot of in the book about what is untranslated and what is translated. I mean, I think when I was writing the book, I had this sudden great love of poets from other countries. And, you know, even great poets who, Zbigniew of Herbert, for instance, or Louise Erdrich in America. So I think what I was discovering at this time is that how much of the writers I liked were poets and novelists, you know, as if they were amphibious. So someone like Raymond Carver, who is known mostly as a short story writer, in fact was a fantastic poet, or D.H. Lawrence, you know, or Juan Gabriel Vasquez. And I became very interested in how they moved from one to another. And then I came across this great remark by Ivo Andrić, who's a Bosnian writer, who was a novelist and poet. And he said, poets, unlike other people, are loyal only in misfortune, and they abandon those who are doing well. And I just kind of love that aspect of, this is the one quality in poets you can trust.
Oh, my. You write a lot about a dog and a cat in your life, too.
Yeah, yeah.
What did they call out to you? What is their untranslated world?
Well, I think there's a delight in animals that they are untranslated. So you interpret them in the best way you can. Anyone who has a dog or has lost a dog or a cat, there's an element of this great loss because it was unsaid, but you knew it was there.
Well, in your poem, November, I made note of these lines. You write very simply, "Oh, Jack, I miss your presence everywhere, in the corners of rooms, in every chair." I think it's one of your most extraordinary poems, and I don't detect any poetic technique in it at all.
No, no. I mean, it was, you know, when we lost him, I think we were just left you were made nonverbal, and you had to begin in a kind of different way to write or celebrate this cat.
You have lines that ask, boy, this gets at me, will I wear a bell like yours into the afterlife where language no longer exists?
Yeah, in some odd way, it becomes one of the closest poems one writes, because it's not just recalling someone, but trying to reinterpret what was absent as well, you know, or that was silent.
The book is called A Year of Last Things. Do you think about what's next?
No, I don't, actually. I mean, when I finish a book, I'm in a very empty landscape of possibility. I'd never really thought about what was next. And this jump from poetry to fiction to poetry to fiction, you know, usually when I finish a book, I feel in some odd ways it's mortal, you know, in a way. You can't go back and rewrite that book. So what tends to happen when I finish a novel that's taken me 4 or 5 years is I want to try and write something where I've never been before. And it could be poetry as opposed to fiction. So you're finding something new constantly to discover.
Michael Ondaatje, his new book of poems, A Year of Last Things. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
That's it for this week on NPR's Book of the Day. If you want more, you can sign up for our newsletter at npr.org/newsletter/books. I'm Andrew Limbaugh. The podcast is produced by Isabella Gomez Sarmiento and edited by Megan Sullivan. Our founding editor is Petra Mayer. The show elements for this week were produced and edited by Melissa Gray, Hiba Ahmad, William Troop, Elena Burnett, Ryan Bank, Shannon Rhodes, Ed McNulty, Samantha Balaban, Martin Patience, Matthew Sherman, and Danny Hensel. Beth Donovan is our managing editor. Thanks for listening.
All that sitting and swiping, your body is adapting to your technology. Learn how and what you can do about it.
I really felt like the cloud in my brain kind of dissipated. Once I started realizing what a difference these little breaks were making, there's no turning back for me.
Take NPR's Body Electric Challenge. Listen to the series wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Online. Is your child asking questions on their homework you don't feel equipped to answer? IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. One subscription gets you everything. One site for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And NPR listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch.